The Jimmy Stewart Museum is a definite must-see for film buffs and Jimmy Stewart fans alike, and you can see it all in Jimmy's hometown of Indiana, Pennsylvania. While far from the cheery holiday tale its title suggests, Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life is a cathartically uplifting, heartbreaking, and heartwarming film in equal measure, and despite its initial box office failure, the movie has grown to be one of the most iconic holiday films of all time. And to talk about the museum and her father's legacy is Jimmy Stewart's daughter, Kelly Stewart Harcourt. Kelly, nice to have you with us. You know, your father is an icon in the movie industry, and I'm sure early on that he had some great talent and knew he wouldn't be taking over his father's hardware business in Indiana, Pennsylvania, right?
I think he certainly got the performing bug at an early age, you know, in as early as school, and his mother and his sisters were very artistic, and his mother played the piano, and he would put on plays as a boy, and he was always in some sort of drama club in his school. So, you know, he probably had an inkling that he wouldn't be taking over the hardware store, and possibly his father did too.
Yeah, I bet. Well, then, all, you know, thinking of what he did in the early days, he went to Princeton. You know, moved to New York, mm-hmm. where his roommate was legendary actor Henry Fonda, and the two sought out to break through on the Broadway scene. And your father did just that.
Yeah, he did pretty well on Broadway, and you know, he shared an apartment with Henry Fonda, who I think there's a story where Fonda used to complain that Dad was getting work, and Fonda was just in the apartment whittling pieces of soap and pieces of wood into animals, because Fonda was very artistic. But I think Dad got discovered by a Hollywood agent, you know, not long after he'd been in New York. Maybe, I'm not sure how long he was there, 2 years at the most, maybe a year. And he went and had a screen test in Hollywood, and that was it.
And that was a big deal because, right, it was MGM. They signed him to a 7-year deal at about $350 a week, and that's about $6,000 a week in today's terms. So that's not too bad for just leaving Indiana, Pennsylvania, hitting New York for a year and a half, whatever it might have been, and getting that shot. And I know he had an unbilled appearance, and I love this because I've read this in several places, in a Shemp Howard comedy short called Art Trouble, but his first film that he was credited for was with Spencer Tracy in The Murder Man in 1934. So this all happened pretty quick.
Really quickly. It's amazing. And his dad always considered himself incredibly lucky.
Really a humble guy.
Incredibly lucky to have got these breaks. He always thought Hollywood treated him very well. You know, he was a fan of the movie system because he worked solidly as soon as he got to Hollywood. I mean, the number of films that he made in a short amount of time is quite astonishing.
It absolutely is. And, you know, one of the things back then, you know, and this is, you know, of course, we're talking about the early 1930s, when sound was really becoming a big part of movies. So, I mean, the studios were really just getting revved up at the time. And now you have your father, big success with MGM, but some of his successes, and they didn't do this very often, but they did it a lot with your father, is he was loaned out to other studios, and that's where he found some of his biggest parts.
Yeah. It's such an interesting concept, a studio owning somebody and then loaning them out.
Yeah, and that's what it was. You pretty much were beholden to that movie company at the time, so knowing you had a 7-year contract and there was other studios after your father, and they said, yeah, go ahead. And again, some of his biggest roles... pretty incredible opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it was give and take. You had less control over the parts you played, but you also had a lot of work.
Now, Jimmy's partnership with Frank Capra started in 1938 for the Columbia film You Can't Take It With You. Then he was on to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where with just a handful of years in Hollywood, he received his first Academy Award nomination. And again, we're talking 4 years in.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah, long relationship.
Pretty
with
amazing.
Yeah, and your family, and I read about this too, and I know there's a new book out about this. Your family has deep military roots, going back to the Civil War, and your father who trained as a pilot. And those of them who really know about Jimmy Stewart might know this. Some of you might not. But trained as a pilot, and he became the first major American movie star to wear a military uniform in World War II. Because you have to remember at the time, you know, pretty much everything came to a halt. I mean, you know, the Hollywood was still making movies, but they were making war movies, and they lost a lot of actors and actresses to the war because they had to go. They were sent to the war.
Yeah. And Dad was very adamant that he wanted to actively to serve actively. You know, he didn't. I think the studios didn't really want to put him in harm's way, and they. It was fine for him to join the military, but they kind of wanted to keep him more as a PR person working for the military from a safe desk or from a safe stage. And Dad really would have none of that.
Yeah, no, he had a couple hundred hours of flying time in right before World War II. I mean, he was almost preparing for it.
Yeah. No, he had his. I think he had gotten his commercial pilot's license before the war, because he always loved flying.
All right, we are talking to Kelly Stewart Harcourt, daughter of legendary actor Jimmy Stewart, about her father's legacy and the Jimmy Stewart Museum in Indiana, Pennsylvania. You know, when your dad came back from World War II, the very first movie he made was It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, it's so fitting.
Right?
You know, it's like it was written in the script.
Yeah, right, of his life. No, you're totally right. And, you know, here's a movie that was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including your dad's 3rd Best Actor nomination. It received very mixed reviews. And I think about how beloved this movie is today. And it got very mixed reviews. Disappointing.
I know.
Yeah, disappointing success at the box office. Like, it did not do very well. I think they lost money on it. And then the movie kind of disappeared for decades.
And I never know the story of what made it reemerge. Was it one thing, or was it just a gradual reappearance on the public scene?
Well, this is what I did a little research here. Now, a copyright lapse aided to really bring that film back to life. So,
It was public domain.
And, you know, found a whole new life on television, particularly when it lapsed. It lapsed in 1974, and it's a shame that even that deep into the 60s, 70s, and 80s that people did not renew copyrights for works of art and music and movies. But it made it royalty-free to anyone who wanted to show it for the next 20 years. So for 20 years, every channel on television had it on at some point. And not the best copies either. There were copies of copies of copies.
I know. And I was living in England for a lot of that time, and it was shown on channels there, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I know the way they secured the rights back was the music. They were able to secure the rights for the music and the theme of the movie and so forth. And you really can't have the movie without some of that in there. And I know that was part of it, to bringing it back into ownership. But, there was a Cheers episode that aired in the late 80s, early 90s, and they were all sitting around the bar, and It's a Wonderful Life came on. And I remember one of the characters said, again, It's a Wonderful Month, because it aired nonstop. But when you think about that, I don't think I actually saw the movie until maybe the late 80s, and it became pretty popular. I found some fun facts about the movie. After years of unsuccessfully trying to shop the story, The Greatest Gift, to publishers, Philip Van Doren Stern decided to give the gift of words to his closest friends for the holidays when he printed up 200 copies of the story and sent them out as a 21-page Christmas card. And David Hempstead, a producer at RKO, ended up getting a hold of it and purchased the movie rights, get this, for $10,000.
Oh, my God. Really?
When you think about how cheap and how quickly this went. When RKO purchased the rights, RKO had Cary Grant in mind because he was contracted under RKO. But so happens in Hollywood, the projects went through ups and downs for several years. And after a number of rewrites and not getting off the ground, RKO sold the movie rights to Frank Capra, who quickly recruited his good friend Jimmy Stewart to play George Bailey. So, I mean, you know, once Frank had it in mind, your father was the guy to play that role.
And, you know, it's hard to imagine another movie that would have worked for Dad right after the war, because I think he came back not really sure what he was going to do. You know, the war changed him, and everybody was different after the war.
Sure.
And, you know, he was wondering if he was going to go back to making movies. And then I think It's a Wonderful Life really spoke to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it wasn't just fluff and fun.
No, you felt like he was living it when you watched that movie.
Yeah.
He was George Bailey, absolutely. Shot on a budget of $3.7 million, which was a lot by 1940 standards. Bedford Falls, which covered a full 4 acres of RKO's ranch, was one of the most elaborate movie sets ever built to that time, with 75 stores and buildings, 20 full-grown oak trees, factories, residential areas, and a 300-yard-long main street. And this is my favorite. The gym floor that turned into a swimming pool was real. Though the bulk of the film was filmed on pre-built sets. Well, that looked so elaborate. You just thought they built that. Someone came up with the idea. It was at Beverly Hills High School, and the retractable floor was not a set piece. It was the swim gym. The school is currently restoring it. But that actually existed way back when. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Jimmy Stewart was the movie's quintessential everyman, a uniquely all-American performer who parlayed his easygoing persona into one of the most successful and enduring careers in film history. But your father was also a true family man, wasn't he, Kelly?
He was a family man, and Dad left his work outside the door when he came home. So it wasn't like growing up, you know, people ask me, what was it like growing up in Hollywood? I don't feel like I did grow up in Hollywood. I feel like I had a pretty normal childhood, really. I mean, I had no idea that Dad was famous until I was 6. It wasn't like it was instilled in us from the time we were born. And, you know, we got glimpses of his fame when we would travel. And there would be crowds asking for his autograph, or there would be interviews with newspapermen. But most of the time, you know, when we lived at Beverly Hills, and I'd go with Dad to the store, or to the pet shop, and get some pet food, and he was just part of the neighborhood.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it wasn't. It wasn't intrusive. It wasn't so intrusive to be famous like it is now. It wasn't as intrusive a life. Every so often, these big buses, movie star tours would come by. But I've always thought that was kind of exciting and sort of fun. And it made us kids proud of Dad. And it was never so much that it was intrusive or onerous or anything like that. And Dad, we learned from Dad that, you know, he believed that his fans made him. He was in partnership with his fans.
Again.
And he never was angry with them. He never was impatient with them. And that was always very impressive to me.
Yeah, a very humble man. A very humble man. Family always came first to him over studio, over work, whatever came about. Your folks were one of the most enduring marriages in Hollywood, married over 45 years. They had quite a relationship. They had quite a partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, they really respected each other and loved each other, and they shared the same sort of sense of humor, which was very important.
And you mentioned living in Beverly Hills, and there was an article out a couple years ago about Roxbury Drive. With neighbors like Lucille Ball, Jack Benny, Ira Gershwin, Agnes Moorehead, Eddie Cantor. Did you have famous, were there people that came around the house, you know, when you were growing up? Was it just a neighborhood thing, you know, or did you not think much of it?
Well, you know, it was every so often Jack Benny would come by and Lucille Ball, but they weren't around all the time. And Mom and Dad didn't give many big parties, and when they did, they would invite friends, you know, Gregory Peck and Henry Fonda, but those weren't the people that they were that they saw all the time. I mean, they're really the close friends that they saw often, like every week. They went out to dinner with or went out to their house. It was sort of people involved in the movie industry, but they weren't big stars.
Gotcha.
You know.
Did you get to know somebody?
I mean, my godfather was Lou Wasserman, who was the, you know, dad's agent.
Yeah, right, right.
From the get-go.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, we had a brush. We were sort of on the periphery as a family. We were, as kids, you know, the glitz of Hollywood and the famous people kind of brushed us, but it didn't engulf us.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And speaks to your father as a husband and a dad and protecting you and giving you a normal life. And I absolutely love this. Now, I know he was a bit of a perfectionist, even when it came to the holidays. What are some of your fondest memories?
Well, I loved Christmas at home. You know, the whole thing of the stockings. Dad would sit down and play some Christmas carols after Christmas dinner, play on the piano, and then it would always evolve into ragtime cowboy jokes. You know, we'd go from it came upon a midnight clear, and he'd always end up with ragtime cowboy jokes.
I love that. You know, he sang that on Carol Burnett's last
always.
Show. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like out of all songs, and I talked to Carol, and she was talking about Jimmy Stewart because he was a hero to her when she went and saw the movies when she was younger. I mean, she'd go see Jimmy Stewart, and when the curtains opened and it was him, she said, boy, he could have played any song, and he sang one of his favorites. And she loved that.
Oh, she's a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there was one Christmas when we all went to Hawaii, and my twin sister and I were about seven. Dad dressed up like Santa Claus, and he came into our room, and he was really acting like Santa Claus, you know, ho, ho, and we were in a hotel on Waikiki Beach, and my sister and I noticed Dad's pajama cuff sticking out from under Santa Claus's sleeve. And so we started kind of being real smart Alex. We were going, hey, Santa, how's it doing? You know, and Dad never broke out of the act.
Well, now you can visit the Jimmy Stewart Museum in Indiana, Pennsylvania. It's filled with wonderful memorabilia from Stewart's Hollywood career, World War II, military service, and his personal life. You can plan your visit Monday through Saturdays, 10 to 4, and Sundays, 12 to 4. Jimmy.org is where you can find out more in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Kelly, thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and your family.
Well, same to you, and thank you very much. I've liked taking a walk down memory lane.
Well, it was my pleasure. Happy holidays to you.